Growing up in the 1920s and 30s in Minnesota's Twin Cities, Charles Schulz would skate in the backyard each winter with his neighborhood buddies. His father, a neighborhood barber, would flood the yard, and it would freeze into a serviceable skating rink. They also skated and played hockey on area ponds and at parks. Schulz, known as Sparky to all who knew him, fondly remembered that simpler time, competing fiercely and even once accidentally giving his close friend Shermie a concussion. Our house had a typical Minnesota basement with an open area beneath the stairs. The space beneath the stairs and the supporting post was about 6 feet and made a pretty good facsimile of a hockey goal. Being very accommodating, my grandmother would take a broom that I gave her and stand in front of this make-believe goal while I shot tennis balls at her with a hockey stick. I like to think she made a lot of great saves. It was the height of the Great Depression, and nearly everyone who played came with rolled-up magazines for shin pads, strapped on with old inner tube rubber they managed to scrounge up. In those early years, a love for skating and hockey played a long-lasting role in Charles Schulz's life. That from Benjamin Clark, writing for Volume 2 of Crease. Remember this, the ice skating scene in A Charlie Brown Christmas, the joyful opening sequence showing the Peanuts gang skating together on a frozen pond while Vince Guaraldi's jazzy skating theme plays. It sets the tone for the special by mixing winter fun with Charlie Brown's quiet melancholy. The Peanuts characters glide, twirl, and laugh together in the snow. Snoopy shows off with tricks, Lucy tumbles, and others slip, adding humor and charm. While everyone else seems cheerful, though, Charlie Brown feels something is missing, foreshadowing his search for the true meaning of Christmas. Snowflakes fall, houses glow with lights, and the pond scene captures the cozy yet bittersweet atmosphere of the special. So the skating scene isn't just a fun winter opener. It's a symbolic moment that frames Charlie Brown's emotional journey against the backdrop of holiday cheer. And it's one thing to experience the ice skating scene in its animated version on TV. Wait until you're drawn into the magic of that sequence at the Alvina Krauss Theater in downtown Bloomsburg as the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble presents A Charlie Brown Christmas by Charles M. Schulz, based on the television special by Bill Melendez and Lee Mendelsohn, with stage adaptation by Eric Schaefer. The BTE resident artist Aaron White, who directs, BTE resident artist Kimmy Moroya, who plays Snoopy, and Amy Renee Byrne, another resident artist, who is a presence they call the animator. The trio paid a visit to the WVIA studios to talk with us about the special and about the place that these characters, Charlie Brown and Scrooge, and how they all wound up one way or the other at some time in the history of holiday shows in Bloomsburg at the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble.
I think their first Christmas Carol was in the early 80s. And for a while, that was the title. And still to this day, as much as we do try and mix it up, there are some conversations I have with people that they do not believe we do anything other than A Christmas Carol during Christmas. Like, oh, you're going to do Christmas Carol this year? No, we are doing a different play.
Yeah, and if we don't do A Christmas Carol, they're like, you're not doing a Christmas play this year? Like, well, no, this one literally has Christmas in the title.
But we do take our duty in providing a traditional, being part of people's traditions very seriously. We all always say that Bloomsburg does Christmas right because Black Friday, there are three different things to do in Bloomsburg. There's Santa, there's Parade of Lights, there's our Tree Fest fundraiser, and there's our show.
Yeah.
When you do A Christmas Carol, you've done many different versions. You've done original versions and straight from Dickens' mouth.
Yeah, well, I mean, there's a long tradition of the ensemble members doing the adaptations. So, and what's interesting about this play is that there's no room for adaptation because it is the 30-minute special that you remember from 1965 and every year since. And we're throwing our own little flair. Amy's, I'll say it's a character.
A presence.
Amy is a presence on stage, but she's not a Peanuts character. She is just cartoon embodied. I've been calling her the animator. But even that, we recognize there's only so little that folks will forgive when it comes to Charlie Brown, right? They know it to be true. So we're certainly paying homage to the source material for sure.
Is this the first time through? Has PTE ever done?
First time.
Yeah, first time. We're hoping that it'll be well received and can be folded into that repertoire of our, you know, a Christmas Carol, a Christmas Story. I'm hoping a Charlie Brown Christmas can join those ranks because there's nothing worse than having to repeat the same show and feel like you're kind of losing your ability to bring something new to it or keep it exciting. And we want to keep our Christmas shows exciting and engaging. And I feel like you can tell when performers are not in it.
Mm-hmm. It's also and the longest run that we do in our season, in that we do 30-some shows. And as a performer in that, you start to get a little fatigued. And so if you're doing the same show the second or third year in a row and you're like another 30 of these, it's a rough time.
Yeah, but also we expect that our audiences, there are some audience members that when we announce the same old shows, they're like, okay, you know, so hopefully we can bring some excitement by offering more and different titles.
Yeah, and I love this title because it's something that I think has nostalgic value for people, even though it's new for BTE to put it on stage. So hopefully we're tapping into that nostalgia machine. And
60 years on, it's its 60th anniversary this year. It came out in 65. And the American Christmas has not changed all that much. Like, some of the things they talk about are still very present.
I mean, I am Charlie Brown.
The one thing that has changed is the prevalence of aluminum Christmas trees. And from what I understand, this special is what killed the aluminum Christmas tree industry.
I did not know that.
Yes.
I did have to pull up pictures and show the kids. I think this was just Friday. I was pulling up pictures of aluminum Christmas trees from the 60s and showing the kids Christmas trees. What? They were like, what do you mean? Why are these trees pink? We don't understand. I'm like, let me show you these highly stylized trees. And like all of the women in their very 60s, bouffant hair, very done up, posing in front of their tinsel trees.
But from what I've read, the disdain that Charlie Brown shows for aluminum Christmas trees and the care that he takes with the real tree is kind of what made people turn the corner on me, like, oh, you know what? The aluminum ones aren't all that great, actually.
And they're a huge fire hazard.
You said animator, and we know of the cartoon origins. To the degree that you can without spoiling it, how do you envision this play unfolding?
So the two other people in this room are also the props designers for this show. And not only are they making the cartoon happen, they also are generating the items that allow that cartoon to manifest.
Yeah. So fun fact, I had not seen this Christmas special until about a week before we started rehearsals.
It was a very normal part of my Christmas. And, so I like to think we balance each other out in that way.
Yeah, but so one of the things I did in preparation, because this was also my first time designing props, was I went through the special and literally took screen grabs of each thing that we were going to be crafting or sourcing, and we have tried our best to make it as true to the item in, like, color matching, shape matching, as true to the item in the special as possible. There's a lot of the cartoon style on it. There's a lot of little what Aaron likes to refer to as Schultz scribbles, which are just like little hatching on the side of an item. We've got some of that going on like the megaphone and the dog bowl and a couple of things that are fun ways that Amy in particular has worked on, like crafting how to bring cartoon effects to life. I think one of the things that I'm most impressed with are the dust for Pigpen, which are, I'll let you talk about them. They're great.
They are, I don't even know how to describe these. I wanted something that moved and that could follow a kid around. And I am there in presence as the animator wielding these dust clouds. And I wish I could take full credit for the structure of them. Gregor, our scene shot manager, and he designed our props for 39 Steps, had made these bird props for the bird. Yeah, the bird part of the Hitchcock riffing. And I took that structure, which was wires in like a bouquet of wires with birds on it that kind of like would bounce. And I have created two bundles of dust clouds out of whisks that, you know, wiggle and bounce and move and can follow Pigpen around.
Because ultimately, many of the conversations we've had is that we are three-dimensional. And part of the fun of bringing an animated series together is that we are three-dimensional, but so much of the fun and so much of what we recognize as peanuts are two-dimensional. They're either in profile or they're facing us. And so Jen, our costume designer, is recognizing that she's costuming 3D people. And so it was a fun sort of tension between if the people are 3D and the setting and the setting is very two-dimensional, we have a very two-dimensional set, how can we play with those two dimensions interacting together? So popping out of the TV screen, as we've been talking a little bit about. So along with the cartoon elements that these two have created, a lot of our staging tends to use cell walking, as in animation cell. So the peanuts kind of do a walking, and then the set moves across as it would on the television screen. So trying to riff on the idea that we are bringing to life into three dimensions these two-dimensional characters.
It's like if you saw a Charlie Brown Christmas in an IMAX theater.
Or in a live theater.
Yeah.
Where they live and breathe.
Yeah, trying to bring cartoon physics to life is a really fun challenge. And that's another area where Aaron has utilized the character of the animator to sort of break traditional physics and make cartoon physics happen. Yeah. And that ice skating scene in the very beginning, being able to pick up Linus and make him go vertical as he gets slung around by Snoopy, is not something we would have been able to do in our space without a little extra something. So
theater magic.
Yeah,
theater magic.
I am that magic.
Yeah, I've also been thinking a lot about how we've been talking about the characters, because the Schultz characters, the peanut kids, are cruel to each other. You know, they were voiced by kids in the original series, and Bill Melendez, who animated it, also kind of coached them and directed them. But they're flat performances, those kids are what they are. There's no polishing them. And to try and help the kids who are in the show, who are really delightful, we have 20 kids, 20 community kids, separated into two casts of 10. But trying to help them achieve that kid cruelty without making them despicable is a real interesting, like, it's one thing to watch an animated character say
you're a real blockhead,
you're
Charlie
a real blockhead
Brown.
Charlie Brown, right? Exactly.
Yeah, like, boy, are you stupid.
Yeah, you can forgive them when they are an animated character. It's really interesting to see a group of kids laugh at Charlie Brown in a really mean-spirited way. Schultz was a big proponent of kids are cruel, and so I will show them being cruel. That's just part of being human nature. But then they also hope, and they also persevere, and they also continue to try when they fail, which is why we like Charlie Brown as much as we do. But it is an interesting thing trying to make these cartoon, the things we would forgive in cartoon land, you need to sort of think more three-dimensionally. One of the things we talked about with the Lucys is she's mean to Charlie Brown in certain moments because she's trying to help him. She's trying to fix the problem of him not being able to find that Christmas spirit, putting him in a position where he's not qualified as a director of a play. And when he fails at it, she is upset. Right? And so you can try to justify that really cruel behavior in a three-dimensional way.
And they have been slow or reluctant to be
Oh,
cruel?
No. No, they're no, right? No. Right? There have been different versions. I will say that there are some kids that when stupid was uttered,
They recoiled.
There's that faction. And then there are others that leaned in real hard and were like just demolishing Charlie Brown. Like Blockhead was like dropping an atomic bomb on our two Charlie Browns. And so it was like, wait, let's see why. You were expecting him to arrive with a solution to your play, and he arrives with this tree. And so that's the way we need to be. Not you are an awful human being, Charlie Brown. You shouldn't exist. You know, that's not how, that's where they went. And we have to kind of craft that performance into a different way.
But they did, in our first read through,
yes.
One of their first reactions after we finished was, wow, they're really mean. They're really mean to Charlie.
Yes.
Charlie Brown, you can't just say Charlie. It's
I know, it doesn't seem right?
Chuck.
And I found increasingly the kids that we've been working with over the last few years have had a really great understanding of themselves and how they interact with others and their boundaries and others' boundaries, and just like a really smart and aware set of kids. And it wasn't any different for this. They immediately clocked how cruel it is. And even though some of them, like Aaron, have watched it 8 million times, and some of them, like me, have not ever seen it, and that was something that they were also kind of wrestling with.
Yeah, I think one of the reasons why it's actually not necessarily a personal, it's not the makeup of them as kids. I agree, they're all very intentional and well-meaning and very sweet people. But there is something seductive about, as an actor, when you get to say something transgressive, you get to say that really ugly thing in a script. Boy, it's so tempting to lean into it and chew
we
on
had
it.
One rehearsal where Aaron had to pull back, I think, 3 or 4 different kids because they were putting so much weight behind every single word that they were saying. It's like, ooh, we gotta put those thoughs back together.
it's a whole sentence.
Yes.
Not just a collection.
Objective word, not words.
You were nodding to Kimmy as Snoopy, so you're Snoopy.
I am Snoopy, yes.
Are there any other grown-ups who are characters?
These kids are carrying the show.
Yes.
And that is, you know, that's something that is kind of also new for us, because even though something like A Christmas Story was very kid-driven, you still have the adult Ralphie narrator who's able to be there and steer them in the right direction. And so this has been an interesting experience, particularly for me, and maybe for Amy, of being like, okay, this scene is kind of out of our hands.
Yeah, there's only so much that we can do. Snoopy doesn't speak. And the animator isn't really there. And so there's only so much that we can do to affect the world or affect the scene. And you can only really lean over into a kid and be like, you need to exit now. So many times.
And I will say that they are certainly rising to the challenge. But it can feel like you're walking on a tightrope from time to time as a director. But we have some really facile kids who have, I like to call them BTE kids, that have come up through our theater education program, our theater school program, and have developed, you know, some really significant skills. And it's fun to see where they land, right? Carson, one of our Charlie Browns, auditioned a couple times and it was not cast in shows. It hopped into the crew, that we have a kid crew as well backstage for Wayside Story. And he would do, every time, Kimmy had a very fun monologue in that show, and he and the rest of the kid crew would reenact the monologue backstage. And I was like, oh, this kid has it and just hasn't found the voice or the vehicle. And Carson showed up. And
we got to have him in classes and work with him in so many ways that I feel like when he did show up for y'all at auditions and like had kind of started to figure it out a little bit, it's like we know he's got the ability, even if self-confidence right out the gate is not necessarily his strong suit, mm-hmm. learning that he's a kid that once he understands what the thing is,
can embody it.
Yeah.
Without any hesitation.
And we know when you have two different Charlie Browns and two different Lucys and mm-hmm. so on and so forth, you're not going to get cookie cutter performances, right?
And nor do we want them, right? We want each and every character to live within the kid. That's part of it, them being three-dimensional things, right? Three-dimensional people. And of course, everyone knows what Charlie Brown is as a iconic character. But it's embodied in a different person. And with that comes their experiences and the way that they would behave. It's funny, between Carson and Cole, there are two Charlie Browns, both C names. Carson knows and embodies the frustration of, like, ah, why? Everything I touched was ruined, right? Like, it is so every...
So visceral in him.
Visceral, yes. You can see it come out of him. And Cole, there are times when, particularly his relationship with Snoopy is so like, oh, I try... this is what I have to deal with. Like, the world weariness is so easy for Cole. Or he embodies it so readily.
Cole is more the Charlie Brown after the football's gotten pulled away from him.
Yes.
And Carson is more the Charlie Brown when he puts the ornament on the tree and it wilts. And he's like, I've killed it.
Yeah. And so they both have their own facility. And it's really and each of the 20 kids has their own special brand that they bring to each of the characters. So.
And the fact that there is a production in the course of the play and Charlie Brown is supposed to be directing it, but that's a little meta scene where it's theater within theater. How do the kids and how do you all have fun with that part of it?
Well, and there it's very, very meta, and there's an additional layer of that where there's a curtain that's hiding our jazz trio that's playing the music that our Schroeder is playing. Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of layers to that scene that are very fun, just meta on meta.
I will say that there are sometimes when there are 20 kids in a room that you can feel like Charlie Brown if you're trying to wrangle. Right. Yeah.
We've got to do the thing.
Yes. But overall.
I was going to say, are Carson and Cole giving their best Aaron White impressions in that scene?
That's a great question. Not that I can recognize.
No, I don't think so.
Also, you mentioned the music.
Yes.
And you have the music behind a curtain. Is it always behind the curtain?
No, they're very much in the middle of our world.
So one of the things that I love about this show is the Vince Guaraldi music. And that is a big part of my holiday tradition. We have the record and we play it every Christmas. And so what's so lovely is that it is live music with three live musicians on stage every night. And we're also, they'll be playing before the show as well. So all the pre-show music is done by the trio. And there are special events that we have scheduled throughout the run. Because it is a half-hour show, right? It is the half-hour special, and we recognize that for it to feel like an event, for it to feel like it's something that's exciting to make part of your tradition, we are doing special events for every night. We have an advent calendar at bte.org that you can go check out.
And they're fun names like Thrifty Thursdays and Memory Matinees.
Yep, and Sing-Along Saturdays, and we have Cocktails and Cocoa on Friday nights. So there's a cocktail hour after the show, which is also kid-friendly, where you can write postcards to Santa, and there will be a selfie competition, and it hopefully will make it feel like, it will make it feel like something really special. And music is an imperative part of that. So the trio will be playing throughout that cocktail hour. Sing-Along Saturdays, we'll have local community groups come in and sing a couple numbers, and then the trio will lead a sing-along as well. So for me, music is always a big part of Christmas. I grew up in the Lutheran church, and so singing carols with my family, it does not feel like Christmas if that doesn't get to happen.
You, Aaron, director, how are you making sure that we get from, you talked about cells, from the opening cell to the closing cell, how does that go in terms of a rhythm for a stage piece?
Well, I will say that the saving grace is the fact that there are live musicians. And there's the rhythm. I think that's actually something special about the Christmas special itself, because it was not a surefire hit when they produced it in 65. Lee Mendelsohn and Bill Melendez watched it, the producer and the animator, after they finished it. And they're like, oh, this is too slow. It's too slow. And the fact that the Bible verse is quoted at the end, like, they were really frightened that Coca-Cola wouldn't be thrilled about the product. And it just so happened they released it, and CBS chose to because they were contractually supposed to. And it worked. It worked. And we continue to watch it. So I think the music is a big part of it. And there are so many Christmas standards that maybe folks don't even realize came from that. There's the snowflake snowball theme, which is this beautiful. That song is in there. So there's that. There's Linus and Lucy, of course. And then there's Christmas Time Is Here, which you kind of have to hear that every Christmas. So that is a structure that gives us a meter for the kids to play on and can continue to drive. So you mentioned the theater scene. No matter how in the weeds the kids get, which they are not getting in the weeds, by the way. They're doing very, very well, if they're listening. But inevitably, the trio kicks in into Linus and Lucy, and we have a dance break. You know, so there's always these sorts of infusions of energy with the music, which I have the luxury of leaning on pretty hard.
Something that was kind of interesting to me Ray Weber, Rachel Weber, our stage manager, was talking to me about how working with a new director always takes a little bit of acclimation. And she previously worked on Sideways Stories from Wayside School with Amy, and how Amy and Rachel's brains work very similarly. And she was having a little bit of difficulty getting quite on the same page as Aaron. And then she found out that he was a dancer before he was an actor, and he's a musician, and music is a huge part of his life. And she's like, that makes sense. And he conducts instead of directs.
Yeah.
And that's what helped Rachel click in.
I also love a good 5, 6, 7, 8 to get us all focused, right? Try to not waste time simply by, because for me as a performer, I recognize not everybody's this way, but I like iteration. I like being able, let's try it again. And so that 5, 6, 7, 8 to be like, oh, we got to get ready to go. And with a group of kids, sometimes that can be very tough because you got a bunch of different energies going in different directions.
Now, how are you channeling your inner Snoopy?
Oh.
Do you lie on top of your doghouse? Do you decorate your doghouse? What is your business if you're not talking?
So this is interesting, right? Because I, like I said, had not seen the specials before. I don't think I've seen any of the other specials. You know, I read some of the Charlie Brown Peanuts comic strips when, you know, parents would get the newspaper and be like, give me the funnies or else. And so, like, you know, I know the main iconic characters, and it's similar anytime you play a character that exists in a cultural setting that people have their idea of how that character is. There's a fine line to walk about making it your own, but also maintaining what people are hoping to see once they come out. So like a couple seasons ago when we did Ms. Holmes and Ms. Watson, and we were playing Sherlock Holmes and Joan Watson, and it was finding that fine line of like, this is my Sherlock Holmes, but it also has to be a Sherlock Holmes that people are going to buy into and come along with. So I probably should, I still have time, could do more research on what Snoopy is, but I kind of just feel like I'm leaning into my inner chaos gremlin.
Which really works for it, and it's remarkable how much what you're finding is so canon Snoopy. Truly, yeah. Like, even just from, like, the little sounds, and there's this moment where Snoopy comes out and does, like, a little jazz number to what Schroeder's playing on the piano, and it's 100% Kimmy, but it's also 100% Snoopy. Because Snoopy is a little bit of a chaos gremlin who's just kind of always doing his own thing,
yeah.
And everyone else is like, all right, man, sure.
Just basically me.
I
do that a lot. The last production we just finished, 39 Steps, I would say that was my MO, was just doing my own thing in the corner.
I'm going to sit here on my doghouse and read my newspaper and eat my bone. And
which I think is to be the foil for, you have the earnestness of Charlie Brown just trying to make it happen, and Lucy who wants direct control of everything, and Snoopy's like, you get none of those things. Like, I will, I'm invested in what I'm invested in, and you being the lone grown-up and being the one who is the least interested in control is such a joyful thing. Yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Are we going to recognize you? Will you be decked out as Snoop?
I have not had my fitting yet, so I'm not 100% sure what our costume is looking like, but our costume designer, Jennifer Lippert, is a big proponent of not dressing animal characters as animals. She is really interested in making costumes that, like, evoke an animal. So last season when we did The Little Prince and Aaron was playing the fox, he had his hair up in little pom-poms, and he had, like, a vest on, and he didn't have a fox tail, but he had some handkerchiefs hanging out of the side of his pocket, which evoked a fox tail. And so Jennifer's design for Snoopy is very similar. I believe I'll be in some white snow pants and have a little hat with some ears going on. And yeah, so I'm looking forward to that.
We'll know you to be Snoopy.
Yes.
For sure.
I'll definitely have a little collar on.
You're not there, so it doesn't matter what you wear.
I am in artist coveralls with some paint. I'm like a light blue, so I kind of blend in a little bit to the background, but a little touch of artist.
Yeah, the idea, because Schultz was such a keen, his first job out of being, he learned to be an artist through a correspondence course. And then he began teaching a correspondence course, and so developing the control of line was a big part of his early career. And so that line is a big part of our design. And as I was thinking about the animator, we also talked a lot about Bill Melendez, who it's his drawings you see in the Christmas special, recognizing that the hand of those creators had a big impact on how we think about these characters. And so I wanted the animator to have the ability to manipulate the world and allow that cartoon to happen. And so the costume certainly evokes that. Amy is also sort of the host of the evening. So she's doing the curtain speech, and every different event that we have is Amy's bag to make sure everyone knows where to get the cool things that we're doing.
Yeah, and Aaron has built this amazing Woodstock puppet, which Woodstock wasn't part of the Christmas special because he didn't come around until the year after.
He appeared in the comics in 67 and wasn't named Woodstock until after the festival in 69.
Yeah. Yeah, but he's a beloved part of the Peanuts franchise, and so Woodstock is going to be making some select appearances before and after, and as part of the photo opportunities and a lot of the special events after the fact. But Aaron has built this phenomenal Woodstock puppet that I will be manipulating and bringing to life.
Lay it out for us.
Well, we kick off with our canned food preview on Black Friday at 2:00 in the afternoon. All you need for your admission is a canned food, and those get donated to the Bloomsburg Food Pantry. And then on Saturday, we have another matinee. And then we kick into our normal schedule where we have Thrifty Thursdays. There's information about all of this on BTE's websites. Fridays are our jazz and cocktail hour post show. Saturdays are our sing along Saturdays. Our matinees on Sundays are memory matinees where there are photo opportunities with Snoopy and Woodstock. And we do matinees during the week for school groups. So
yes, if you're an educator or you want your child's school to come see the show, then reach out and we can see if we can get you scheduled in for our student matinees. Yeah, they fill up pretty quick.
There's limited availability for those school matinees because they're selling very well. But we run all the way through after Christmas. So we run to the week before Christmas, and then we have three performances on the 26th and 27th. On the 26th and 27th after Christmas. So it's a long, long and wonderful Christmas spirit-filled month.
Yeah. Yeah, and if you want to kick off your Black Friday in Bloomsburg style, you can come to our canned food preview and then parade to Tree Fest and then stick around for the Parade of Lights.
BTE resident artists. We heard just there Amy Renee Byrne, who is taking the role of the animator and MC throughout it all, with Kimmy Moroya, who is playing Snoopy. Both Amy and Kimmy are creating the props. And Aaron White, who is directing the production of A Charlie Brown Christmas by Charles M. Schultz, based on the television special by Bill Melendez and Lee Mendelsohn, with stage adaptation by Eric Schaefer. The show runs from November 28th through the 27th at the Alvina Krauss Theater in downtown Bloomsburg, 226 Center Street. And for more information, bte.org, bte.org. Again, a special food preview on Friday, November 28th at 2 in the afternoon. Instead of paying a traditional admission fee, audience members will be able to donate a canned or non-perishable food item to the Bloomsburg Food Cupboard. On Saturday the 29th, BTE will host the low price preview at 2 in the afternoon. And then the opening night performance will take place at 7:30 Saturday, November 29th. The Kathy Bauss sensory-friendly performance will be held on December 6th at 2 in the afternoon. And when the shows are launched in their regular routine, showtimes are 7:30 p.m. on Thursdays and Fridays, 2 and 7:30 on Saturdays, and 3 in the afternoon on Sundays. For more information, bte.org. And if you're able to attend and would like to attend the sensory-friendly show, admission is free. BTE.org, A Charlie Brown Christmas, by Charles M. Schulz, based on the television special by Bill Melendez and Lee Mendelsohn, with a stage adaptation by Eric Schaefer, directed by Aaron White, and presented by the Bloomsburg Theater Ensemble November 28th through the 27th. And there will be time off for Christmas Day and probably Christmas Eve. Check the website for all the details, bte.org, bte.org.